Sounds like a lovely world to live in. Barry Eichengreen, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Barry Eichengreen is a professor of economics and political science at UC Berkeley. His latest book, The Populist Temptation, Economic Grievance and Political Reaction in the Modern Era.
And that takes us to just past 8 o'clock in the morning here at KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley, KPFB 89.3 FM in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 FM in Fresno, or K248BR 97.5 FM in Santa Cruz, and online around the world at www.kpfa.org. I'm Brian Edwards-Tieker.
And I'm Antonia Yuhas.
And while we were consumed with the news coming out of federal courts in Washington and New York last week, the Trump administration made a move that could have very big consequences for people here in California. They asked for a reopener on a 32-year-old agreement that governs how state and federal authorities release water to and move water through the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta. We're going to take a deep dive on what that would mean for the Delta, for water, and for money in a state that is highly dependent on water for just about every part of our economy. That's coming up next after the news.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. President Trump's declaration of victory Monday in reaching a preliminary deal with Mexico to replace the North American Free Trade Agreement raised at least as many questions as it answered. A deal with Canada remains in the offing. Canadian Foreign Minister Chrystia Freeland will be in Washington today for negotiations. It may not be legal for Trump to reach a replacement trade deal with Mexico without including Canada. Trump campaigned on an anti-NAFTA platform and disparaged the treaty Monday at the White House.
We'll get rid of the name NAFTA. It has a bad connotation because the United States was hurt very badly by NAFTA for many years, and now it's a really good deal for both countries.
Trump did suggest that he might leave Canada out of a new agreement. He said he wanted to call the revamped trade pact the United States-Mexico Trade Agreement because, in his view, NAFTA had earned a reputation for being harmful to American workers. But first, he said he would give Canada a chance to get back in. To intensify the pressure on Ottawa to agree to his terms, the president threatened to impose new taxes on Canadian car imports. China is challenging the latest round of U.S. tariffs against Chinese goods through the World Trade Organization. The Chinese government on Monday formally requested dispute consultations with the United States over the Trump administration's imposition of $16 billion in tariffs on Chinese goods last week. China has responded with similar taxes on U.S. goods. The request to the World Trade Organization opens a 60-day period for the two countries to hold talks. China already is holding talks with the U.S. about its previous tariffs on both Chinese steel and aluminum products and over alleged Chinese violations of U.S. intellectual property protections. All told, the administration is preparing tariffs on $200 billion in Chinese products. China has vowed to retaliate on American goods worth $60 billion. The UN's top human rights body says the governments of Yemen, the United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia may have been responsible for war crimes, including rape, torture, and disappearances during 3.5 years of escalated fighting between Houthi rebels in Yemen. In their first report for the Human Rights Council, UN experts also point to possible crimes by rebel Shiite Houthi militias in Yemen, who have been fighting the Saudi-led coalition and Yemen's government in a civil war since 2015. The experts have also chronicled the damages from coalition airstrikes, the single most lethal force in the fighting over the last year. UN expert Charles Garraway.
Individuals in the government of Yemen and the coalition, including Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, may have conducted attacks in violation of the principles of distinction, proportionality, and/or precautions, which may amount to war crimes.
The UN urged the international community to refrain from providing arms that could be used in the conflict, an apparent reference to countries including the U.S. and Britain that help arm the Saudi coalition, as well as Iran, which the coalition has accused of arming the Houthis. Important primaries are being held today in Arizona and Florida. In Arizona, Republicans are running for the seat of retiring Senator Jeff Flake. Flake has been a vocal Trump critic, which could play a role as the state's GOP moves further to the right toward Trump and away from Flake and the late John McCain. The outcome of Tuesday's primary will be closely watched by Arizona Governor Doug Ducey. He must name a replacement to fill John McCain's seat for the next 2 years. McCain died Saturday of brain cancer. Florida is also holding a primary today, while voters in Oklahoma participate in a runoff for governor. Florida voters are going to the polls to select nominees to replace Republican Governor Rick Scott. President Trump has endorsed U.S. Representative Ron DeSantis in the Republican primary for governor over Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam. Former Democratic U.S. Representative Gwen Graham is trying to fend off four challengers as she seeks to become the state's first woman governor. A 12-week road trip to call attention to the plight of hundreds of thousands of immigrants who may lose their temporary permission to live and work in the U.S. made a stop Monday in San Francisco. KPFA's Scott Baba was there and has this report.
The San Francisco visit is just one stop on the group's 12-week 50-city tour of the United States that began in Los Angeles and will ultimately end in Washington, D.C. It's aimed at raising awareness of the difficult position of immigrants who have recently lost their temporary protected status, or TPS. Fiona Meyer is a member of the NorCal TPS committee and helped organize the rally.
We're really just trying to raise awareness of the cause of TPS, make people understand the plight these people are in as TPS is taken away and they're often offered no next steps. So they're really in a place of limbo and they deserve a path to permanent residency.
TPS allows status holders to live and work temporarily in the United States while their own nations recover from the effects of armed conflict or natural disasters. The move directly affects over 300,000 people out of the estimated 435,000 people in the program. Kate Waldman, a spokesperson for DHS, said in a statement last week that, as intended by Congress, TPS was always meant to be a temporary mechanism to address urgent humanitarian conditions. For countries where an extension is justified under the law, DHS has issued appropriate extensions to assist those affected by the conditions prescribed in statute. In San Francisco, I'm Scott Baba, Pacifica Radio, KPFA.
San Francisco may be allowed to pilot a program to let people inject heroin and other drugs under medical supervision in an effort to curb overdose deaths. The California Assembly voted Monday to send the governor a bill allowing San Francisco to operate so-called safe injection sites. The sites would provide sterile needles, and people would be allowed to use illegal drugs there without fear of arrest. Stockton Assemblywoman Susan Talamantes Eggman says her bill would help connect addicts to treatment, but opponents say they worry it will encourage prolonged drug use. Partly cloudy today in the San Francisco Bay Area, highs in the 60s and 70s, overnight lows in the 50s, and the central San Joaquin Valley, clear with highs around 90. I'm Max Pringle. News returns at 8:30 on KPFA.
It is just past 8:08 in the morning, and you're listening to Upfront. I'm Antonia Yuhas.
And I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert. Big environmental news for Californians came out of the Trump administration last week, but kind of got lost in the ocean of coverage about all the figures in Trumpland who were either convicted, pled guilty, or revealed to be cooperating with federal investigators. The U.S. Bureau of Reclamation has given California officials notice that it wants to renegotiate the 32-year-old deal that governs how state and federal governments release water to and move water through the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta. This deal is called the Coordinated Operation Agreement. The Trump administration wants to send more of its federally controlled water to growers in the Central Valley. For complicated reasons, that would put the state in the position of cutting water flows to Los Angeles, among other places. At stake, hundreds of thousands of acre feet of water, billions of dollars of economic activity, and the ecological viability of the largest estuary on the Pacific seaboard. Joining us to talk about it, via Skype, we have Greg Gartrell. He's a retired assistant general manager at the Contra Costa Water District, where he managed Delta projects, now an adjunct fellow at the Water Center of the Public Policy Institute of California. Thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
And on the phone, Barbara Barragan-Perea. She's executive director of Restore the Delta. Thank you for joining us, Barbara.
Good morning. Thank you.
Greg, I was hoping you could start by just kind of setting the table and explaining what the Coordinated Operation Agreement does and why someone who is not a water geek should care.
Yeah, okay. Let me start by just giving a short summary of what it does. There are regulations that need to be met in the Delta that require water flowing through the Delta into the San Francisco Bay and out to the ocean. And there are those regulations are for every month of the year. They control salinity and they provide flows needed for the ecosystem in the Delta. The coordinated operations agreement between the State Water Project and the Central Valley Project tells each of those projects during certain periods of time how much water each needs to release in order to meet those flows. For example, during the summer, when flows are needed to be added so that they meet those regulations, 75% of that water comes from federal reservoirs, Shasta, Folsom, and some from the Trinity River. And the 25% will come from Lake Oroville, which is a state water project. There are other times of the year when there's enough water just coming out of the mountains from snowmelt or rain, when there's sufficient water for meeting that outflow, and there's extra water that both can pump without releasing more water from their reservoirs. And that agreement also tells the two projects how much they can take each pump when during those periods when they're not pumping at the maximum rate. Otherwise, it'd be fighting over who pumps how much or who releases how much. And that's exactly what happened in the 1970s, during the 1976-77 drought, before they had an agreement. The Central Valley Project simply decided how much they were going to release, and they put the rest of the burden on the State Water Project. Subsequent to that, there was a court decision that required the Central Valley Project to meet California law with respect to water rights. Up to that point, the Bureau of Reclamation's view was they had sovereign immunity and they could decide what to do with their project, provided they stayed within the quantity of water that the water rights gave them. So after that, they got serious about negotiating an agreement with the State Water Project. It was a long, contentious negotiation. It involved calculations of how much water each had and would be required under various circumstances. And they came down from a very, very complicated calculation and negotiation to basically two numbers, the 75-25 and the 55-45. And that aligns more or less with the amount of storage the Central Valley Project has. It has far more storage than the State Water Project. And at the same time, the State Water Project has far more pumping capacity. They can pump up to 10,000 cubic feet per second, while the federal project is limited to about 4,500 cubic feet per second, less than half that. So between the two, they can decide how to operate this.
The takeaway on the attempted reopener here is the federal government wants to pump more water to Central Valley growers. The contracts are generally with irrigation districts, not the growers themselves. But that's
correct.
Who benefits. What are the interests? Why does the federal government care whether there's more water going to them, to the Delta Smelt, or to water users in metropolitan Los Angeles?
Well, the curious thing is that in the regulations that the Coordinated Operations Agreement was based on were formulated in 1978 by the State Water Resources Control Board. In 1994-95, an agreement was negotiated among the Department of Water Resources, the Bureau of Reclamation, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, at that time, California Department of Fish and Game, now California Department of Fish and Wildlife Service, National Marine Fisheries Service, various environmental interests and various water user interests, and that was given a name, the Delta Accord. And that changed entirely the amount of water that was required to be put out. Up to that point, the water that was required to be put out of the Delta was pretty much for water quality purposes, to allow farmers in the Delta to have sufficiently fresh water that they could put on their lands for irrigation, and to protect municipal and industrial uses of those who take water out of the Delta. After that point, there was another million acre feet of water that was dedicated for environmental purposes. And at that time, they could have renegotiated then, but they chose instead to use another section of the Coordinated Operation Agreement and just come to an agreement on how they were going to divide up the cost of those new regulations. That happened again in 2008 when, through a series of lawsuits, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and National Marine Fisheries Service imposed new regulations under the Endangered Species Act that cost them several hundred thousand acre feet more, depending on the year type. In wet years, it cost them about 1 million acre feet. In the drier years, about 300,000 acre feet. They had the opportunity at that time again to renegotiate, but they chose instead to decide pretty much on the fly how they were going to divide up that additional cost. I think through a series of studies that has occurred over the last several years, the Central Valley Project contractors, those in the Central Valley primarily, but also some in the Bay Area, Contra Costa Water District and Santa Clara Valley Water District, are CVP contractors, realized that they, under the rules that they were operating in, under that they had agreed upon, the CVP was putting out more water, more than its fair share of water. And I think the DWR disagreed with that, Department of Water Resources disagreed with that. And the Central Valley Project now wants to force the issue by invoking a clause in the Coordinated Operation Agreement to formally renegotiate it and redo the studies to determine how much each should put out.
I want to bring into the conversation Barbara Berrigan-Perea. The backdrop to this is that the state on its own has been reallocating or proposing to reallocate water flows in the Delta, looking to boost the minimum amount of water that's available just to keep the ecosystem healthy and the fish alive and salt water from going in the pump intakes. This has been controversial in and of itself. You have been maintaining the position that even what the state's considering is insufficient. What are your concerns?
Well, first off, the water quality plan, the Bay Delta Water Quality Plan, and right now we're dealing with just phase one, which has to do with flows through the San Joaquin River into the Delta and the Bay. It's an improvement for the Delta, but it really doesn't go far enough. There are three problems. Science, the best available science shows that we need through the San Joaquin River and into the Delta 50 to 60% unimpaired flow. Right now, they're recommending an average year of 40% unimpaired flow. It improves conditions in the Delta, but it certainly doesn't go far enough to meet goals required under the law for the doubling of salmon populations and really to improve the overall ecosystem and health. There's also a problem with the state plan. They want to weaken the South Delta salinity standard. And that South Delta salinity standard isn't just about protecting farmers and their lands, even though it does help with farming in that part of the Delta. It's about keeping water fresh enough for fisheries, for all the beneficial uses of water. The Delta has a large environmental justice population. Water cost, water treatment would become more expensive, and that would be passed along to people who really can't afford to pay much more in their monthly water bills. Also, there's no language within the plan as proposed right now by the state to ensure that any increased flows will actually reach the San Francisco Bay and they won't be exported to Westlands or Stuart Resnick's Empire in Kern County or Metropolitan Water District. One thing, you know, I think that's important for people to also understand when they're thinking about the coordinated operating agreement, what the Trump administration is proposing, moves like the Denham Rider, which is in the House Appropriations Bill to restrict flows in the Delta, that we have a problem, and this is actually from a PPIC document. We have an insufficient accounting of how some categories of environmental flows move through the Delta. You know, right now, Delta outflow lumps together the way it's recorded. Water for keeping the Delta fresh enough for human uses and protecting aquatic habitat for fish. During the 2012 to 2016 drought, the ecosystem water was actually a very small share of total outflows from the Delta into the bay. You know, water that we had moving through the system was really to protect water quality for people in the Delta and also people dependent on export water.
To keep salt water from backing up into their groundwater, their
Correct.
Wells and the intakes.
Right. And to keep temperature under control so that, and to keep water moving so that you don't have a accumulation of stagnant pollutants in the Delta as well.
And speaking right now is Barbara Berrigan-Perla. She's executive director of Restore the Delta. Barbara, you had mentioned Kern County. And, of course, of concern with Kern County is the ever-increasing water usage there to try to get more oil out of older wells. Is there any relationship to this this deal with water moving in or out of Kern?
We did an analysis, I want to say about 6 years ago, with the Center for Biological Diversity, where we did a water accounting of how much water was actually used for injection oil production and fracking. And to be honest with you, we oppose those processes at Restore the Delta because it contaminates their local water wells, which will make them more dependent on the Delta for drinking water. But in terms of the amount of water that's exported, 70% of the water that's taken for the Delta really goes for big industrial ag. It's a pretty small percentage. Unless there are water sales, we cannot track behind the scenes, and that's always a possibility. But the biggest problem is that we have so much water going for large-scale industrial ag, almond production. There's, over a million acres of almonds in California now, with a large part of them on the west side of the San Joaquin Valley. We've planted crops on drainage-impaired lands in the Central Valley Project in Westlands all the way down to the west side of Kern. And that part of California's agricultural economy, which uses so much water from the Delta, only contributes 0.3% to the state's GDP.
Hmm. Greg Gartrell kind of laid out a situation where there are a lot of competing interests and guardrails, there are environmental regulations, there are federal court decisions. When the Trump administration says it wants a reopener on the coordinated operation agreement regarding water in the Delta, how much latitude do they have? How much leverage do they have in local authorities? If their position is, we don't want to release any water for the fish, we want to send it all to Central Valley growers, what restraints exist on them?
Okay. Well. First, this is first and foremost in the Coordinated Operations Agreement. It's a fight between two big elephants, the two big pumps, the State Water Project and the Central Valley Project. So the folks who are most affected directly by that, not to diminish others who are indirectly, because it can have some serious consequences elsewhere. But most direct are their contractors. So that would mean if you live in San Francisco,
you mean the people who hold water contracts?
Yes. Yeah. From the State Project and the Central Valley Project. So if you live in the city of San Francisco, go buy some popcorn and sit back and watch the fight, because you're not going to be much affected. Same if you live in Marin. You have your water supply from other areas. Now, San Francisco is, of course, involved in the other thing that Barbara was talking about regarding the amount of flow coming down the San Joaquin, very much so. And they, of course, oppose that. They don't want to give any of their water to the fish on the San Joaquin River. That's a different fight. But if you live in the East Bay, Contra Costa Water District, or East Bay Mud has a Central Valley Project contract, although it's not a lot of their water, it's an important supply in dry times. Or in Alameda County Water District, if you get your water from them, or in Alameda Zone 7, which is the Livermore area, you are affected by this. And if you're in the Santa Clara Valley Water District in Santa Clara County, you've got an interesting position, because Santa Clara Valley Water District gets their water from both the Central Valley Project and the State Water Project. So they got a foot on both sides of this fence. But if you're down in the valley and you're Westlands Water District, well, you're going to be rooting for the CVP to get more water. If you're in Kern County, you're going to be afraid the CVP is going to be taking water from you, and the same for Southern California. If there is a good argument that that the CVP could end up with as much as 200,000 to 400,000 acre feet that they're not getting now, that's going to the state water project.
And I'm
going to
translate. CVP is the Central Valley Project. That's the federally controlled.
Yeah, Central Valley Project. Yeah. That's the federal project. That would be Contra Costa Water District, Westlands Water District, part of Santa Clara, East Bay Mud. On the other hand, the losers in that scenario would be Livermore area, Alameda County Water District. The other, you know, part of a Santa Clara Valley Water District would both win and lose there. The big losers would be Metropolitan Water District, Southern California, and Kern County water agencies. But this is extremely complicated and hasn't been done in a long time. The CVP has the advantage of having lots of storage. The SWP, as I previously mentioned, has...
That's the state water project.
Yeah, that's the state water project. It has much bigger pumps. And so there, as there was the last time, there's likely to be some horse trading going on. And that's where the indirect impacts can come in, because they can work on this. They can, if they do it wrong, they can both end up with a little bit less water, but shifting one from one side to the other in a big way. But the outside world would gain a little bit of water. If they do it the way they would like to, well, they'll both, maybe one side will lose a little bit, the other side will gain a little bit. But the outside in the Delta will end up with less water, because they've worked out a way to operate in tandem so they can take more water overall. So it's something that everybody has an interest in ultimately. But the big winners and losers will be contractors and their customers.
Let me, before we wrap up, bring Barbara Berrigan-Perla back in. And Barbara, let me just to go back really quickly to one thing you had said in the last section. I just wanted to highlight that the report that you had mentioned looking at water usage by oil and gas, particularly for fracking in Kern County, as you'd mentioned, was 6 years old. So just to say, a lot has change in the amount of water usage that's needed, but not to argue with the fact that disproportionately, of course, agriculture is the biggest consumer of water, but to keep our eyes out on the usage for oil and gas. Can you tell us, you know, what's the process moving forward now? What should listeners be watching for if they want to engage in how this water negotiation goes on? What's happening at the state level? What's happening at the federal level?
Well, at the federal level, there are a couple of things I see differently than Dr. Gartrell. I mean, the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation has been holding meetings to change the Endangered Species Act requirements for operating the pumps in the Delta and the coordinated operating agreement. They haven't moved to bring in all people, impacted parties, really to the table. There's a desire to gut the Endangered Species Act so as to open up those pumps to really take as much water as desired out of the Delta. You know, our state law under the Delta Reform Act requires reduced reliance on the Delta. And what's really problematic about the negotiations and this move by the federal government is that no one's going to want to give up anything that's exporting water. Mm. But no one's going to want to adhere to the law about reducing reliance on the Delta. And you couple that with loosening up Endangered Species Act requirements, it could be really problematic and really tragic for what the water quality impacts could be for fisheries and people who live in the Delta. There are 4 million Delta residents in the 5 Delta counties. On the state water plans, I think it's really important for people to remember that people in San Francisco necessarily don't march in line with the SFPUC. People in San Francisco tend to favor saving the Delta and saving rivers and having enough unimpaired flow to move through rivers to keep them living and healthy and productive and to protect the Bay Area.
I'm going to jump in and translate. That's the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. They control the water system for San Francisco, and they've been arguing for not being forced to release more water into the Delta from their Hetch Hetchy supply.
Right. Yeah, that's correct.
That's correct. So there is this disconnect between what the people of San Francisco want and what the utility wants, and that's because utilities keep themselves relevant through water sales. So they have an interest in being able to control that water supply and be able to sell it to consumers. And that's because of the way we fund our major utilities, water utilities in California. It's funded through water sales. I think the other important things to watch for with this are particularly the Denham Valadao riders that are in Congress that are tied to the appropriations bill.
And you're referring to Jeff Denham, a Republican who represents the Modesto area in Congress.
Right. And Congressman David Valadao, who is further down in the valley. In particular, that Valadao rider would eliminate the right for parties to litigate against the State Water Project or the Central Valley Project for its operations. And I think the timing that that rider was put into place before movement to open up the coordinated operating agreement and change the rules is very, very telling. And of course, in all of this, we cannot forget that David Barnhart, who was the lawyer and lobbyist for Westlands, is number two at the Department of Interior, that he is the person who is lobbying for these changes for the benefit of Westlands Water District. So I think the question that's going to become up is, you can only export so much water from the Delta if we're going to have a Delta and fisheries and protect the people in this region. Beyond that, where does it make the most sense to share water with the economic powerhouses of our cities that generate large economies, or in a system on drainage-impaired lands on the west side of the San Joaquin Valley for agriculture that produces very little in terms of GDP?
All right. Well, that's a question we're going to have to end on because we're out of time. Barbara Berrigan-Perea, always good to talk to you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's the voice of Barbara Berrigan-Perea. She's executive director of Restore the Delta. And joining us via Skype for this segment, Greg Gartrell, retired assistant general manager at the Contra Costa Water District, where he managed Delta projects. Thank you to you, sir.
Thank you very much for having me.
That takes us to 8:32 in the morning. The program's up front. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiekert.
And I'm Antonia Yuhas.
And coming up, as this legislature of California crashes towards its final deadline for approving bills this session, which is this Thursday, there is one bill in play that could mark a major shift in this state's energy economy, SB 100, which is being championed by Kevin DeLeon, currently making a run to unseat his fellow Democrat in the Senate, would put California on a track, according to its supporters, to get 100% of its electricity from renewable sources. We're going to talk about one of the advocates and policy wonks behind the bill, about what it would entail, when we come back after the news.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. The preliminary trade deal with Mexico leaves some open questions. Some wonder if President Trump can reach a replacement NAFTA deal with Mexico alone if Canada can't be coaxed to come aboard. Trump has suggested he might leave Canada out. Feature Story News's Kate Fisher reports.
This was originally a trilateral agreement, and at the moment we only have two countries who are signed onto it, the US and Mexico. Mexico making it very clear, the president making it clear that he wants Canada to be part of this deal again, and negotiations will begin on Tuesday morning here in Washington with the Canadian team to try to get that sorted. Donald Trump, he said he's not committed to a trilateral deal, and if he can't get the one he wants, he's happy to make separate bilateral agreements with Mexico and Canada.
And that report from Feature Story News is Kate Fisher. President Trump promised today to address what he says is the very serious situation of social media companies suppressing conservative voices and hiding information and good news. Trump recently has made similar complaints about the issue, which has been making the rounds in conservative media, but today he targeted Google. Asked whether Trump thinks Google should be subject to some kind of regulation, Larry Kudlow, the president's top economic advisor, told reporters, quote, "We're taking a look. We'll let you know." The president said in a pre-dawn tweet that included a typo that a search for Trump News on Google shows only the viewing reports of fake news media. In other words, they have it rigged for me and others so that almost all stories and news is bad, unquote. Federal judges have affirmed their earlier decision striking North Carolina's congressional district as unconstitutional because Republicans drew them with excessive partisanship. That's after the U.S. Supreme Court ordered the case be reexamined. The three-judge panel ruled Monday again for election advocacy groups and Democrats who sued to challenge North Carolina's congressional boundaries. Judges previously deemed the map an illegal partisan gerrymander that violated constitutional protections of Democratic voters. But the Supreme Court ordered them in June to take a second look based on a Wisconsin redistricting case in which justices found plaintiffs hadn't proven they had the right to challenge the lines. The Greensboro-based court raised the possibility that North Carolina's 13 districts could be redrawn for this year's elections. The California Assembly has denied an appeal by a former lawmaker of an investigation that found he sexually harassed a lobbyist in 2016. Former Assemblyman Matt DeBobne had appealed the finding that he likely pushed the lobbyist into a bathroom at a party and masturbated in front of her. Documents released by the Assembly Rules Committee today say his appeal was reviewed and rejected. He denies harassing the lobbyist and is suing her for defamation. Partly cloudy today in the San Francisco Bay Area, highs in the 60s and 70s, overnight lows in the 50s, and the central San Joaquin Valley clear with highs around 90. I'm Max Pringle. News returns at 10 on KPFA.
You know it's coming, Election Day, November 6th, with the balance of power in Washington in question, and supporters and opponents of the Trump administration counting on the outcome. There are also numerous California elected offices at stake and important ballot measures in many states on issues like reproductive rights, marijuana legalization, district reapportionment, and much more. Hi, I'm Larry Bensky, and I'll be returning to KPFA's airwaves with a new weekly program, Countdown 2018, every Friday at noon. We'll talk to people around the country about what's going on in their area, take your phone calls and emails live on the air, and hopefully add clarity to the complicated electoral picture. That's Countdown 2018 every Friday at noon on KPFA 94.1 FM and on the internet at kpfa.org. Join us.
It is 8:37 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert.
And I'm Antonia Yuhas.
And this is the final rush to get bills approved before the legislative session ends in Sacramento on Thursday at midnight. Among them, one of the most significant initiatives on the climate policy front this year, SB 100, would move the state towards getting 100% of its electricity from renewable sources. Now, this is a process the state has been moving forward on incrementally since 2002, when it passed its first renewable energy mandate. And there's a pattern that has repeated itself frequently since then, which is the state sets a target, imposes it on utilities, and finds out it is on track to reach that target ahead of schedule and imposes stricter ones. Still, a 100% renewable energy goal would be, needless to say, the most ambitious in the nation. We're joined in studio by one of the advocates who's been working on getting it passed. Laura Wisland is a senior energy analyst at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Thank you so much for coming in this morning.
Good morning.
Walk us through the mechanics of the bill. What is this going to change about the law? What is it going to mean for power providers?
Sure. So SB 100, it actually, let me make a slight distinction. It's not technically 100% renewables. It's 100% carbon-free power. And the reason why there's a distinction is because we have a law in the books today called the Renewables Portfolio Standard. And currently that requires that 50% of our electricity come from RPS-eligible renewables like solar, wind, geothermal, bioenergy by 2030. This bill would raise the RPS to 60% by 2030.
That's the Renewable Portfolio Standard.
The Renewable Portfolio Standard. And then it sets an additional goal of reaching 100% carbon-free power by 2045. So that remainder 40% could be met by RPS-eligible renewables like solar and wind and geothermal, or it could be met by other sources of power that don't count for the RPS but also don't emit carbon. For example, large hydropower. The state gets about 15% of its electricity right now from large hydropower, and nuclear would technically count as well.
Even though California has shut down all its nuclear power plants.
Well, Diablo Canyon is still running. It is on track to be shut down by 2025. We get about 10% of our power right now from nuclear. That's going to go down significantly once Diablo goes offline. But we still do get a fraction of imports from a nuclear power plant in Arizona.
Got it. So the line out of the energy industry, and we tried our best. We put in requests with Pacific Gas and Electric. They didn't return our calls. We reached out to a group that seems to be largely backed by the oil industry that's sending out press releases opposed to this bill, Californians for Affordable and Reliable Energy. They also did not return our request for an interview. Their argument has been that electricity is already too expensive in California. This will make it more expensive. What's your response?
Actually, my response is that when you look at all the prices of building new power plants, renewables right now, solar and wind in particular, are cheaper to build than a new natural gas plant or certainly a new nuclear plant. And so, happily, renewables are not only the cleanest option on the table for new power sources, but also the most cost effective. So I don't think this is going to raise electricity prices.
So right now, we still get a certain percentage of electricity generation from imported coal. What percentage is that right now?
It's a small fraction. It's about 6%. Okay. And that also is going to be phased out. So we passed another bill in 2006 that said that any long-term contracts we have with coal plants are not to be renewed. So a lot of that coal, mostly coming into Southern California right now, is going to be phased out by the early 2020s.
Do we already have in California enough electricity, the capacity to generate enough electricity from wind and solar that we're ready to replace what we would shift from other sources?
So our biggest shift is going to be turning down the natural gas. We get about a third of our electricity right now from natural gas. So the importance of SB 100 is that this sets the table for the conversation on how we're going to do that. And we think it's critical to do that. Climate change is probably the biggest threat that we're facing in terms of our economy and public health and general well-being, both for, you know, our country, our state, and our world. And we also know that getting off fossil fuels and powering our electricity needs with clean carbon-free sources of power is probably one of the most important things we can do to address climate change. So we need to have that conversation, and we're not going to have the conversation about how to go all the way and turn off all the fossil fuel until we have policy support like SB 100 to do it. We have most of the tools already to get to 100%. It's, you know, no place in the world yet has actually done that. California is not afraid to be a leader on these issues, and like Brian mentioned, when we set goals, we consistently overachieve them achieve them ahead of schedule. So I have no doubt that by 2045, we're going to figure out a way to do this.
Yeah. But like the natural gas is an interesting conundrum. The state built a wave of new gas-fired power plants in the early aughts after the energy crisis. And they're typically built for and financed for an operating life of at least 30 years. To meet the goals in this plan, would they have to be shut down ahead of schedule?
Some of them probably will be shut down ahead of schedule. Some of them are being shut down ahead of schedule right now. So you're right, we did build a lot of natural gas in the late 90s and early aughts, but we also got really serious about renewables, and the cost of renewables came down. So we were also bringing online a lot of renewables in the early aughts and middle 2000s as well. So we're getting to the point where renewables and gas are starting to come to a head. And some of the gas is being shut down because we simply don't need it anymore. It's not economic to run those plants.
What is the move within the bill? So right now it says sustainable energy, as you've described. That could mean nuclear power. That could mean natural gas. Tell us about the behind-the-scenes fight to make this 100% renewable energy, and how close are we to having, you know, the movement be to that as opposed to sustainable energy?
Well, I think that it's important to keep the legislative language as broad as possible, just not so that we don't fall into the trap of spending a lot of time arguing about what counts. It's important to do the first step, which is to set that big, overarching, inspirational goal. Once SB 100 passes, fingers crossed, we will have the discussion about what's the most cost-effective combination of resources that's going to get us to that ultimate goal of 100% carbon-free. What does that glide path away from fossil fuel looks like? look like? How do we do that in the most reliable way, the most socially equitable way, and the way that's going to be most cost effective for our electricity customers?
Speaking to Laura Wisland, she is a senior energy analyst at the Union of Concerned Scientists, one of many, many environmental organizations that are backing SB 100, which may come up for its final vote on the state assembly floor as early as this afternoon. You talk a little bit about the balance of power in Sacramento. Who fights initiatives like this? How much traction do they have in state politics?
Well, I mean, as you said, you asked PG&E to come speak today about the bill. I think PG&E is, well, I know that they're not supporting the bill. They have supported renewable energy initiatives in the past. I think at this point they're really focused on wildfire liability issues. I don't want to characterize their opposition, but, you know, the utilities generally don't like being told what to do. And again, SB 100 is a combination of a mandate. It would require that all the utilities in the state reach 50% RPS, so renewable portfolio standard eligible renewables by 2030, but then sets that larger term goal of 2045. I think that traditional groups that are representing large scale energy consumers are just always thinking about electricity costs and tend to not support any initiative that rocks the boat at all in terms of business as usual electricity production.
That's interesting. I was trying to figure out why there appeared to be so many oil industry organizations investing and lobbying against this. I guess that's because refineries are huge electricity consumers?
They are, and they do generate some of their own electricity, but they also purchase some as well. So they're thinking about electricity rates.
Aren't they also thinking about what type of regulation could be that they could be next for? So the largest standing source of greenhouse gas emissions in the state are refineries, are oil and gas refineries. Are they? Go ahead.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. That's a really good point. And that actually reminds me of something else. One of the other reasons why we're so excited about SB 100 is because, you know, we've made a lot of progress to reduce carbon associated with traditional electricity production, in large part because of the success we've had bringing online renewable energy. The biggest source of greenhouse gas emissions and air pollution in the state comes from transportation, cars and trucks. That's really our next big fight. One of the key ways to reduce pollution in that sector is going to be transitioning those cars and trucks away from petroleum and towards electricity. And we want that electricity to be as clean as possible.
And the largest, so I was saying, a stationary source is the oil and gas refineries. So the other piece of this then is transportation, obviously key, shifting away from fossil fuels. But then getting at those oil and gas refineries that are creating all this greenhouse gas emissions and pollution and smog is the other piece of the equation, which is the production side. So keeping fossil fuels in the ground. You know, where is that part of the discussion fitting in? One of the things that I've looked at as concern for the sort of long-term future with fossil fuels is that they're also seeing the writing on the wall about electricity generation, about transportation, and they're looking towards petrochemicals and the making of plastics as their next big, you know, so their next big investment. This is what we're going to produce oil and natural gas for, is to make billions and billions, billions of dollars in plastics. And so looking at the equation of also just simply stopping the production of oil and gas, and where is that fitting into this, you know, equation of negotiations at the Capitol?
I don't think it's fitting explicitly into the conversations we're having around SB 100, because that's really about the electricity sector. But I think it's part of this larger conversation that California is having, because it's a climate leader, because we're facing very imminent threats of climate change, as we can see from the wildfires, because the governor is putting together this climate summit in the fall. We are having a larger discussion about how to reduce emissions across all sectors of the economy and do so in a way that, you know, makes sense for our economy and grows jobs. So I do think that spending some time, I think that once we figure out what our glide path away from fossil fuels is in the electricity sector, we are going to need to turn more of our attention towards larger industrial stationary sources of energy production.
Well, I look at the legislative record here. As it's made its way through assembly committees, this bill has passed by 2-1 margins everywhere it's been up for a vote, which seems to indicate the critical point is going to be Governor Jerry Brown here. As I said, the lobbying offensive against it seems to be largely coming from the oil sector. Jerry Brown has on occasion been quite accommodating of the oil industry's desires in California. Do you know where he's going to land on this bill if it hits his desk?
You know, I don't want to speak for the governor, but I can say that he's been an ardent supporter of clean energy policies over the years, and he is putting together this climate summit, and we expect that if SB 100 passes the legislature, him signing that bill is going to be a keystone achievement to help show California how we are an example as a climate leader moving forward.
That's the Global Climate Action Summit beginning in less than 2 weeks, the week of September the 10th. I believe the official start date is September 13th. There is a coalition of international and national and state groups organizing to push the governor and all those attending the summit to go beyond what's currently being promised and take really aggressive action to address climate injustice and address the climate. And those events start even earlier with a big march on September the 8th taking place in San Francisco. Is there a concern that SB 100, for its exceptionally laudable goals, doesn't go far enough for what we need right now and what might be possible to achieve right now?
Well, I mean, I don't think that it goes far enough to address everything that we need to address to stave off the worst impacts of climate change. You know, as I said before, this really focuses on the electricity sector. We know that clean sources of electricity are going to be key to reducing emissions across different sectors of the economy, most importantly, transportation. So I think it's a huge first step, but California definitely cannot stop once it passes SB 100. We have still a lot more work to do.
And the actual targets in the bill, the target is 100% renewable or 100% carbon free by 2045. 2045 is still 27 years away. Are you happy with that level of ambition, or is that a compromise? Is that a deadline you'd like to see tightened?
Well, I think that I'm happy that we are ratcheting up our current requirement because we know we're going to surpass 50% renewables by 2030. We're already on track to surpass that. So I think it makes a lot of sense to ratchet that up to 60% by 2030, we know we can go faster. In terms of how do we get from 60% renewables to 100% carbon-free in 15 years, I think I'm comfortable with setting the legislation like that and then having an open-ended conversation with the energy agencies once we get into the implementation phase about what that pathway should look like. Like, you know, we said before, California always seems to surpass its goals and move faster than it thinks it can. I feel very confident that we're going to be able to do that again. And I think that the legislation has enough flexibility in it that we could move faster if we want to. And in fact, some cities and some utilities have already made a pledge to go to 100% even faster than 2045. So there's nothing in this legislation that ties anybody's hands to move faster if they want to.
But to the cost argument that's being advanced by the business organizations I mentioned earlier, if California moves so aggressively that it's mothballing a bunch of relatively new fossil fuel burning power plants, natural gas plants, that is going to create stranded assets. It's going to create costs. Those will be passed on to ratepayers, won't they?
Well, it depends on who owns the power plant. So if a utility owns the power plant and that power plant is being basically paid for by electricity customers, then you could be dealing with some stranded asset issues. And that certainly is the case for some publicly owned utilities that own power plants that were built in the late 90s and early 2000s. But a lot of our natural gas fleet in California is actually owned by independent power producers, just independent companies. And so if those plants decide to shut down early, that's their financial loss.
How big of a fight do you see looming over those who want to keep natural gas as part of this sustainable energy portfolio and those who want to shift as quickly as possible to 100% renewables?
I think that the conversation has been heating up recently about what the role of natural gas will be in California's near-term future and what the glide path away from natural gas looks like and how quickly we can do that. So I don't think that the natural gas industry is going to go down without a fight. But I also think we have very, very strong tools to prove that we have cost-effective alternatives to natural gas right now. I'm not saying that we can turn off all the natural gas tomorrow, but we can turn a lot of it off. And a bill like SB 100, which sets the table for the discussion about how you turn it all off, really helps us have that productive conversation about what that glide path looks like.
There is a concern environmental justice groups have had with California's renewable portfolio standards. And I believe it holds under this bill too, which is it includes in its definition of renewable energy, energy that comes from burning trash, landfill incineration. That produces a lot of concerns about toxic emissions for the communities that are close to the point of incineration. How did that make it into the definition? It's not a very widespread practice in California.
So it's actually, there is only one municipal solid waste incinerator that actually counts as RPS eligible renewables. It's in Stanislaus County. It was grandfathered in as part of the discussion in the early aughts. I'm actually not sure why that one incinerator made it into the bill, but that is the only one that actually counts. You can't, aside from that facility, you can't burn trash and create electricity and call that renewable.
You mean you couldn't start a new landfill incinerator project?
Correct.
Interesting.
Someone just got their project grandfathered in somewhere. Someone's going to have to track down that legislative record to see who made that deal and try and undo that deal. How confident do you feel in passage today and that this SB 100 is going to become law, if not today, in the near future?
I'm really excited about the prospects of this bill. I've been really encouraged by the dialogue in the legislature. I think there's a lot of optimism that we can move faster. I think that our state has just really matured very quickly in terms of our understanding of how far and how fast we can move with renewable energy, how cost-effective it is these days. So I feel pretty confident that we're going to make it over the finish line.
All right. Laura Wisland, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks.
Laura Wisland is a senior energy analyst at the Union of Concerned Scientists, one of the many environmental organizations trying to secure passage of SB 100, which would put California on a track to producing 100% carbon-free electricity by the year 2045. Again, we did reach out to two of the organizations that are on record opposing this bill. Pacific Gas and Electric did not return our calls. The organization called Californians for Affordable and Reliable Energy, which appears to be operated out of the offices of the California Business Roundtable, sent us press releases, but also did not respond to our request for an interview.
And that does it for today's show. Upfront airs weekday mornings at 7 a.m., We post information about our topics and our guests online at kpfa.org, where you can also dig through our archives, subscribe to the show as a podcast, and connect to us on social media.
If you want to sound off about something you heard or suggest something for us to cover, send an email to upfront@kpfa.org.
Big thanks to everyone who makes this show happen. Producer Corinne Smith, engineer Kirsten Thomas, hosts myself, Antonia Juhas.
And me, Brian Edwards Tiekert.
Also Gina Madrid and Janine Etter. Our intern is Justin Gold. Also Mitch Jezerich and Eileen Alfandari.
Stay up, stay tuned. Democracy Now! Is coming your way at 9 o'clock.
This is a listing of upcoming events in the Bay Area for the week ending September 9th. All events are wheelchair accessible. Please listen closely for contact numbers. NIAID Arts Center, which nurtures artists with disabilities, is having the opening reception of multiple art pieces, including Talking Heads, Prince, Wild Color, and Robots. The reception starts at 1 p.m. on Saturday, September 8th at 551 23rd Street in Richmond. For details, call 510-620-0290. You can dance, play, and have fun with your child at Luna Dance Institute's Open House, where Luna's nationally acclaimed approach to creative dance and improvisation for all ages is highlighted. This event takes place from 10 a.m. to noon on Saturday, September 8th. The studio is located at 605 Addison Street in Berkeley. For details, call 510-883-1118. The 47th Annual Mountain View Arts and Wine Festival will be a vibrant celebration of life featuring live music, food, and 500 professional artists and craft makers. This event starts on Saturday, September 8th at 11 a.m. and takes place on Castro Street in Mountain View. For details, call 650-968-8378. The community calendar is produced by members of the First Voice Apprenticeship Program. Send your listing at least 4 weeks in advance to KPFA Box 51, 1929 Martin Luther King Jr. Way in Berkeley, California, 94704. Or email us at calendar@kpfa.org. Tell us if your event is wheelchair accessible. To hear this calendar again, call 510-848-6767, extension 621. This calendar is also online at kpfa.org. Oh,